Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this program, for those of you who have not heard it before, deals with largely with Russian and Ukrainian history relative to the Orthodox Church, and of course all issues concerning the Orthodox life, whether it be in Europe or in the United States. This is being recorded from Johnstown, Pennsylvania, one of the most Orthodox and Slavic areas of America. Today, although there's so much going on in the world as far as nationalism and the church is concerned, everyone seems to be preoccupied with this pan-Orthodox sobor in Greece or Cyprus, wherever it's supposed to be. And I've gotten a lot of emails about this, and my response is simply to say that on the one hand, if what they say is in accordance with the Orthodox Church, it's not important. We know all this already, and if what they say is not in accordance with it, then we simply ignore it. I need to reiterate for people, Orthodox people who come to the church for the first time, especially from the Roman Church, that bishops don't lead or rule anything. The role of the bishop is to be more or less the chief priest of the diocese, to be involved in the administration and things of finances and clerical discipline. He gets a strong role in the seminary. But keep in mind that the bishop, when he refers to himself in the plural. He refers to himself as we. And he does this for a few reasons, one of which is that he's not seen as an individual person. The office is a collective one. Every diocese has a diocesan council. That includes the clergy, the monastics, and some laymen. And this is the office of the bishop. The bishop's role has been so wildly exaggerated in the Orthodox world, they don't rule the church in the sense that a monarch runs a country. In fact, ruling the church, traditionally, if it comes from anybody, it comes from the monarch. Bishops have always been seen as a problem, and the result is that monarchs are the ones who called synods and councils in the past. A council can only be ecumenical if it, in fact, is called by an emperor. Now, Vladimir Putin is not an emperor, but he comes very, very close. That has to be cleared up. The bishops and synods, they come together when there's a problem in the church, and they take something that's already Orthodox according to doctrine, and then what they do is clarify it relative to that particular problem. Now, I, being a part of the true Orthodox Church, that is to say, the anti-modernist old calendar movement, in my case, from Greece, from the Synod of Auxentius, because of that, I realized that this council is going to anathematize us, but which was actually has already been done. When the calendar change came into force in the 1920s, the Church of Greece anathematized all of the people who rejected it and said that these people are without grace. Right afterwards, you have the appearance of the cross, which was the initial miracle of the true Orthodox world, as if to say, don't listen to them. Bishops differ from us only relative to their function. They have no channel of grace that's different from anybody else. They have no greater holiness than anybody else. They are prone to error and actually really spend a lot of time proving to the world that they're prone to error. So, this I'm underwhelmed by this pan-Orthodox council. And I guarantee you that if it ever actually occurs, what it will say will be uninteresting, unimportant, and probably very wrong. And of course, it can never be ecumenical. Although there is, can Vladimir Putin call a ecumenical a council? I'm not sure I would like that, because although he is a first-class statesman, and he is also Orthodox, and I have an article on this on my website, rushjournal.org. He favors the World Orthodox, the World Orthodox mission, and for people who have they've criticized me, I've always been a supporter of Putin. Most of you know my book, Russian Populist: The Political Thought of Vladimir Putin, is a strong defense of his rule. But I'm criticized because Putin has been involved in ecumenical relations with the Pope of Rome. Now, ecumenism has always made me laugh with Catholicism. I have the feeling that a lot of these Orthodox bishops don't know that the traditional liturgy of the Roman Church has long since been jettisoned. Their liturgy is pretty much anything goes. I have never witnessed things like the clown mass and the pogo stick mass and all these other things that they do. And this present pope has largely said that Christianity has been bad for the world. Way too many homosexuals have been persecuted because of it, and therefore he rejects it. He says the Roman Church is really not the true church. It's just one of many. So there are plenty of popes from the old world that are rolling over in their graves, banging on the lid of their coffins at this character. So I'm not sure what is in it for anyone in the Orthodox Church to have anything to do with the Church of Rome, except possibly financial. The only thing I could think of is that ecumenical relations are about plugging in to Western money, which, of course, in and of itself is a sinful motivation. Money brings misery. Yes, I know paying bills is important, but generally speaking, money brings misery and pain. What I don't understand, both with Putin and Lukashenko, their devotion to the World Council of Churches, I have the feeling that this is strictly political. Putin's devotion is well known, although Lukashenko says that he is a secular man, but does respect the church as an institution, as a corporate body, as part of Belarusian culture. Vladimir Putin is an actual believer and was baptized secretly as a child. And he has always been, having to spout the Marxist slogans when you're coming up through the ranks. And this is unimportant. It's sort of like a white male university professor overcompensating from the fact that he's so vulnerable to charges of racism by being the most militant anti-racist in the world. And these are comical people. Putin and Lukashenko are anything but comical. In fact, they're not very funny at all. But they in supporting the World Council of Churches, in supporting any kind of ecumenical endeavor, they're not serving their own interests in the sense that their constituency is not interested in this. Putin's constituency has always been Russian nationalists, patriots, Christian people. Being involved in ecumenical relations with the Pope of Rome is not in his interest politically. Given the fact that Putin is not insane, there's got to be another reason. I personally have not gotten to the bottom of it. I don't know what is motivating him in that regard. I was born and raised Roman Catholic. My father was an atheist. My mother was a Sunday Christian. I fell away in high school. And I look back now, the Novus Ordo and the Roman liturgy was so uninspiring, and everything had been so badly deflated that there was nothing really to hang on to. And then in graduate school, I got involved with the Latin Mass movement and then moving to the Byzantine Rite. And when I attached myself to the Ukrainian Church in Lincoln, Nebraska, as I was getting my doctoral degree, and actually they were quite instrumental in that process, I became very interested in the Eastern liturgies. I'd already been neck deep in Slavic and Soviet studies at that time, but the Ukrainian unions got me very interested in the Orthodox world in both Ukraine and Russia. I had been introduced to it before, but was not a part of it. And that decision was not made until late in grad school when I became Orthodox. Regardless of that, part of the mission of this show is to deal with everything that has to do with both nationalism by itself and Orthodoxy by itself. Russia is usually the connecting tissue between those two ideas. Today I want to talk about something different, something that's very, very close to the Orthodox mind, the Orthodox idea. It has political and social implications, and that is the notion of the family. The family is a term that's very broad in its older usage. Of course, it refers to the extended family. It refers to numerous generations and branches of the family as a whole. The nuclear family is a very, it's a 20th century idea. In fact, I believe it's very much a 1960s idea, where the family has already been truncated and it only refers to mother and father and children. Today, as with many words like that, it has absolutely no meaning. But natural law, and this is not my personal opinion, natural law has decreed in God's creation that the individual, the person, doesn't exist. It can't. Thomas Hobbes wanted the world to believe that people popped out of the ground like mushrooms. And that's because his Leviathan was extremely individualist. He only dealt with individuals in the so-called state of nature, where they had no ties whatsoever, no family ties, no national ties. And that's the problem with modern political thinking in that era. The state of nature is absurd in that all, the big three thinkers in that area, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, all posited a single person. And yet we're born completely helpless. The family is in and of itself generally helpless. It requires the cooperation of an entire nation, of an entire society, in order to make it viable. The individual doesn't exist. I don't mean that there's, the individual should be quashed. I just mean to say that nothing about individual life is individual. We communicate with others based on a language that we did not invent. We have ideas that we absorb that we didn't create. We live in a world that we didn't make. The rules by which it lives, we had nothing to do with passing. When a libertarian tells me about how important it is that the individual be seen as a root of everything, I remind him that the very act of saying that has required generations of cooperation and context. The fact that you did not invent that argument or invent the idea that the ego, the individual, is the center of everything, shows that the individual is not the center of everything. Nothing that we do is of our making. Our talents and everything else, they come from genetics, they come from God, they come from our environment, they come from our training, anything but us as isolated people. But the modern era is born on the idea of nominalism and on the individual. This is natural law. This is not of my creation. There are certain truths out there in the political realm that are beyond anyone's personal opinion, and this is one of the central ones. The family, society, the nation, these are primary units because they're the only units that are actually self-efficient. There are only a few nations, confederations in the world that can be completely autarkic. The United States is one, and the Russian Empire is another. In fact, by the turn of the 20th century, the Russian Empire was almost completely autarkic. There's nothing that it contains there's nothing that it fails to contain that they have to import from somewhere else. One of the absurdities about free trade is that something that we can grow in our backyard is being imported from overseas. I'm not sure why most of our flowers are grown in Mexico and then shipped to florists from these things that seem ridiculous. The United States actually could be completely autarkic if absolutely necessary. This is the nature of the family. And nationalism is simply the idea that nations function very much as families function and have a corporate identity just like families do. Now, why do I bring this up? Well, I have an article out on an online journal called Europe Wide, a journal that I like, dealing with these kind of issues. The title of it is Women as a New Nobility, Feminism, the Rule of Law, or excuse me, the Rule of Fear, and Contempt for Thought. So the title gives you some inclination as to what I'm going to say here. And I've noticed that nationalists, a lot of Orthodox people on the paleoconservatives and those on the right, really are very much afraid of this issue. Now, I know why. The issue is very simple, actually. Though no fault of our own, a man's self-esteem is largely in the hands of the women that he fancies. This is something that all men have felt. This is something that I, even today, can't shake. And that provides them with a tremendous amount of power. In the article that I wrote, was published in May of this year, I'm talking about an English Marxist by the name of Belfort Box. And he's an eccentric Marxist only in the sense that he makes the argument in several books and articles that women, and he's talking about, you know, Victorian era England, charge rents based on this notion of self-esteem. That men go so far out of their way to protect women that they become this noble class. The idea of female privilege, especially in the age of feminism, is a fact. Again, this is one of these things that's not my personal opinion. In the United States, attractive young women, have a very easy life. All of the things being equal. You know, if they have cancer, they don't have an easy life. But as an attractive woman, their standard of living is extraordinary. They have more power over men than any other form of rule could not match their kind of power. There's an article out there on the notion of female privilege, and it's very difficult to argue with it. And in fact, I go so far to say that we live under a gynocracy. And I began to recognize this around the time I hit puberty. He has a whole list of things, privileges that that women have over men, and I would say that these are triply applicable when the woman is attractive. I think that being attractive and young, especially if you have no morals, this is really the key, rather than just being a woman as such. The gynocracy is shown by the fact that a woman cannot be struck, cannot be hit, but a man could be hit without mercy and with no consequences. My understanding is that, you know, women are protected, especially as any good man would want to do, because they are physically smaller and weaker than men. And yet the problem is that even a slight, unaggressive, very meek man, when being hit by the opposite type of woman, is still not a problem. So it's women as such. An attractive woman will get whatever she wants. Now, unfortunately, you have to be nihilistic to do this. To marry up for them is very easy. They could automatically increase their social status. No one can deny that men will do anything to please them. They throw money at them. They throw jobs at them. I know one person I'm thinking of right now who is getting her entire law degree based on the fact that she is living with a wealthy man, and she's living with a wealthy older man because she's extremely attractive. Now, again, you're judging these people is very hard. They're playing the card that they dealt, but men can't do any of this. They can ask for help and cry without stigma. My sister, who's blonde, always says, whenever I'm in trouble, my car doesn't start or something like this, I just stand in the middle of the parking lot and cry. And even as a much older woman, men come streaming. They come streaming from states away to come and to help her. On the one hand, it's a very healthy thing, because a man's role is, among other things, to protect her, a woman. But the age of feminism isn't so much about promoting females in society. They always had immense power. It's about justifying that power and providing sort of an ideology for women to begin tapping into, to be able to use to justify the power that they have. The most important proof, but I shouldn't say this, one of the most important proofs of the gynocracy is that females are, their feelings are far more important than a man's well-being. An entire huge corporation can be brought to its knees with a single complaint of sexual harassment. If the media gets word of this, it doesn't matter how powerful the company is. Sexual harassment and these kind of things, which are very vague, they are exclusively the domain defined by the woman herself, within very broad limits, is, you know, considered this awful crime. And a huge corporation often has to pay quite a bit of money to get out of this, and even more. The very accusation of something like that, socially speaking, is just as bad as a conviction. The Bill Cosby fiasco is proof of this. We have no idea whatsoever if Bill Cosby actually did any of these things. And yet I haven't come across an article yet or a video yet that doesn't assume that he is convicted. They have removed his name from all of his endorsements. And yet we have no idea if any of these accusations are true. They've been dropped all over the place in a lot of places. They're mostly very, very old, 30-year-old accusations. The idea that somehow they're afraid to come forward is nonsense. Men know, some through experience, some just by reading about it. They know that the tiniest complaint about any kind of abuse, especially something as serious as rape, leads to an automatic arrest of the man, an automatic protective order that comes into existence as a condition of bail, which sometimes we forget about, and the man is out of your life forever, and then you are given a free lawyer and income and support, and just the entire society comes behind you. So it's laughable that that women are afraid to come forward. Some of you may have come across this. It's very depressing. One of my favorite guitar players is Tony Iommi. And part of the reason is because he doesn't have fingertips, and I just he had to adjust. And he invented the genre of heavy metal. Back in the 80s, I remember he was engaged to a female, moderately, vaguely attractive female guitar player named Lita Ford. Blonde, never really amounted to anything professionally. Her only autobiography just was released, and almost on cue, she says that Tony physically abused me. Now, I found this odd because this is the first time she's mentioning this in almost 30 years. And here she is, a heavy metal star with millions of male fans and money. Not a huge star, but her entire stardom comes exclusively from the fact that she's female and vaguely attractive. Not a bad guitar player. There's plenty of male guitar players who haven't, decent guitar players who haven't amounted to any. There's no evidence, and this is just something, I think, maybe to jumpstart her career. But the accusation alone is already bringing her all kinds of support. Women need to stop doing this. Women need to stop accusing men of rape or assault or anything like this to get out of a problem. To provide themselves with greater social status. They need to stop this. When it happens, the man needs to be punished severely. But now we're in a situation where these false accusations are everywhere and they're happening all the time. The reason for this is really the proof that we are in a gynocracy. As a young man, just as an aside, as a young man, the rule of women was made very graphic to me when I began to realize that in a romantic relationship, especially in the very beginning, all the emotional vulnerability is shoved onto men, not to mention the financial obligation. 14-year-old boy who fancies a girl has to do all of the approaching, has to do all the talking. She could simply just sit there, and the man is taking all of that vulnerability onto himself, and we all know what it's like to be rejected. But from the female point of view, if you're even vaguely attractive, really all you need to do is walk into a party, sit down, cross your legs, and just hold court. And men, in one case, actually literally will throw money at you. I've actually seen that happen before. And they begin competing with each other to see how much they could humiliate themselves in order to please her. This is not my personal opinion. This can be observed anywhere. The more important proof, more important issue involved here is the idea of the false accusation. No one denies that rape and assault, that these are very, very serious crimes. Not as serious as the media will have us believe, but they are still very serious crimes. The research, especially recently, that isn't put out by feminist writers, generally suggests that as many as 80% of these are false. To accuse someone of rape is a very serious matter, and the woman who is doing it has to have no morality whatsoever. And this is the downside. I think the downside being an attractive female is that you end up having to sleep with a lot of really ugly people. But, you know, as my mother used to say, they all feel the same in the dark. But the University of Michigan, the U.S. Air Force, who actually had to in 1985, commission its own study, Vassar, and I believe George Mason University over the last 10 years put out research suggesting that between 50% and 80% of rape claims are false. So far as domestic violence is concerned, Psychology Today has just put out a report on several studies suggesting that as much as 70% of domestic violence situations where there's been an arrest or just an inquisition, where it's not reciprocal, is female. And there's certainly a very good reason to believe that, partially because domestic violence against men is rarely reported. So whatever the figure is, you could just triple it, and you would be probably, even there, would be understating. But there's a growing body of literature suggesting that the false accusation, now thank God this has not happened to me, but I know of several men who have been through this. And even if, or even in one case, even as they were acquitted, they're bankrupt from paying a lawyer. They often have lost jobs, and they have really become a social pariah because even the accusation is sufficient. Michael Jackson was accused of doing this, the Neverland Ranch, and then he was completely acquitted, and yet he still has that reputation. The people who brought the suit were in desperate straits, and they made this accusation. I think many of you know recently this alleged porn stash from that initial raid 16 years ago is only now being discovered. You know, this is catnip to the press, and they sell this, and like in the Cosby case, I tend to believe he's innocent because there's no reason for him to be doing any. He has no motive. Some women will say that it's power. You know, obviously, sexuality isn't the issue. Power is the issue. And yet, you know, again, Bill Cosby had more than that than we could even imagine. But the fact is that domestic violence, false accusations are very common. There's a body of literature out there suggesting that there are tremendous rewards for the false accusation. Several months ago, I was commissioned by one of Pennsylvania's poorer counties, not the county that I live in, but one of the poorer counties in Pennsylvania. Their bar association had asked me to do a paper on gender issues in criminal law, and more specifically, in the lower reaches of the misdemeanor, the second and third class misdemeanors, as well as the summary charges. And a lot of that, of course, has to do with domestic violence complaints. And I began doing research on Pennsylvania's law referring to accusations of assault, violence, domestic abuse, and also the civil issue. In fact, the only civil issue I dealt with was the what's called the protection from abuse order, or what some people call a restraining order. In Pennsylvania, it's called a PFA and comes from the Protection from Abuse Act that was passed in the late 1970s. Now, I knew the system was rotten. I knew that the modern world and what we live under was degenerate and beyond repair. I knew that we lived in a gynocracy, but I was not prepared for what I found. In fact, I was so stricken by this that I contacted three defense attorneys, all three of whom were quite willing to allow themselves to be quoted so long as I didn't reveal their identities. Two females and one male from three different counties in Pennsylvania, one of whom, the female, I knew. And I needed to make sure that what I was uncovering, not just in the statute itself, more importantly, the case law. You know, I read everything from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to the Superior Court to local courts on these decisions and what happens when one of these and how it works. Many people don't know the mechanics of it. It was uncovering the mechanics of it and how these things are interpreted that I was absolutely I was changed. It was so severe and so bizarre. I knew things were bad, but I was not prepared for this. And in fact, I concluded this by saying that I think I know why 80% of all suicides are male. Why white males in particular kill themselves, and especially over family issues. I think I may have found one of the reasons. I believe that this mechanic exists in other states. Pennsylvania is a more conservative state. I'm not sure where they stand hierarchically with the severity in terms of other restraining orders and PFAs in different parts of the country. But I couldn't believe what someone who is accused of this goes through. I didn't look at the system the same way again. It's only been a few months, but the very fact that I needed to call people for backup on this can't be true. This can't be real. I need verification, and all three were quite willing to verify it. This has not happened to me, thank God, but I know two men, and not in Pennsylvania though, that have been through this, and it is an absolute nightmare. Understand that it is a civil proceeding, which means A, double jeopardy can be violated if there's a criminal case, and B, you're not guaranteed a lawyer. So right away, it's a bit of a racket. You have feminist power showing itself. You have a tremendous income stream for the state. And you begin seeing who really rules the society. I ended this research report from several months ago, and I didn't say this to them, of course, but in my mind, I said, I have proven beyond doubt the existence of gynocracy. On the website that I mentioned, the online journal, Europe-wide, I have all of the citations of the different court cases that, as well as the statute itself, that back up what I'm saying. And you may consult that or contact me privately, and I'll send you all of the cases. Understand that in Pennsylvania and in many other states, the state government mandates that every county has to have a advocacy group for women's issues, domestic violence issues. Now, in and of itself, that's not a problem. There are plenty of women who are beaten and tormented by men, usually with alcohol and drugs being involved, but not nearly as much as a feminist would like you to believe. One of the reasons that they can inflate these numbers is that they use restraining order figures to show that men are just insatiable when it comes to cruelty. And yet restraining orders are meaningless in terms of evidence. So understand every county has to have an advocacy organization. These organizations, needless to say, are run by extreme feminists. This is something in my contacts that I made over the last few months, this has certainly been verified. And furthermore, they have a legal team there that does nothing but these kind of orders 24 hours a day. So you have the feminist movement, which is now completely official, and in each county, government-funded, partially government-funded. And so when there is a claim to some kind of a domestic violence, that's who you go to. Now, the very fact that it simply can't be covered by an arrest, that if something like this happens, it's awful, shouldn't be done under most circumstances, but you call the police and go the criminal route. The fact that's not the obvious approach here is disturbing. So I read the law. I've read much of the case law, and one of my contacts sent me a case study with all the personal information that had been redacted. Just one case study, which was considered normal for these kind of things. The restraining order requires no evidence. And this is something that threw me at first. It's a civil claim, but the conception of evidence would suggest that it has criminal elements to it. I was told, you see it in the case law quite often, that the protective order is not meant as a punishment. It says nothing about whether or not you've actually been an abuser in the past. It seeks to prevent abuse in the future. Therefore, questions of evidence as to whether or not you did some of these things that you're accused of are completely irrelevant. According to the Supreme Court, the only thing that the claimant has to demonstrate is that she is afraid, which is very easy to do if you are a good actress. Again, this benefits only the most amoral, but it is a very, very powerful weapon. The way that it works in Pennsylvania, I think in a lot of other states, is that someone making this claim goes in front of a on-call judge. There's a judge in every county that is always in session, 24 hours a day, and they rotate this. And you make the claim that I am frightened of X, he beat me up, he shot me, he did whatever, and I require a restraining order against him. The other party, the number of constitutional violations here is far too many for me to even discuss right now. But this is an ex parte hearing, meaning that the other party does not have to be present. Now, going over the statistics from the state of Pennsylvania, of all the thousands and thousands of these hearings held every year, zero were rejected. None were rejected. That's one thing to grant something like this. If a woman comes in and, you know, with a broken leg, obviously beaten and abused by someone, but it equally applies to women that come in, you know, strong, tall, tattooed women swaggering in, wanting to punish their ex. It requires no evidence. You don't have to. You don't have to produce any. That would fall into then the realm of a criminal trial. And that would then imply that the protective order is punitive. It is not punitive. Therefore, any claim that the man has been violent or and you don't have to claim violence, by the way. It can be you know, anything but having hurt feelings in a severe way. I mean, it can get really silly like this. Generally speaking, it's about violence or threats of violence, but it is not required. Verbal abuse, that kind of thing, would also count. So you don't have to bring it through. The ex parte hearing is about 10 minutes. Now, the woman who is making this claim has free legal representation. Each of these feminist groups that are officially set up in each county and well-funded have an entire legal team. So you go to them with this complaint, and then they will, in many cases, actually dress you up, bring a free lawyer to the on-call judge, and they, since they do this every day, they know exactly what to say and what to do. They even practice their lines. I've heard this from more than one source. It would be one thing, you know, if the woman shows signs of being abused. Well, if that's the case, then I don't care what happens to the man. He should be punished. But that's not the case in most of these, especially if there is no criminal case that parallels it. If there's not enough evidence to provide probable cause, then the woman is lying. A protective order is granted all the time, with no exceptions, at the ex parte hearing. The sheriff's office then visits the man wherever he's living, in his own house, serves him these papers, and he is evicted. Now, it doesn't end there. Being evicted from your home because a woman is upset, that's bad enough. But support orders are built in to many, if not most, of these protective orders. Now, this is what threw me. This is what I didn't know before. Many of them, and there's no hearing as to what the support order is, so you can pretty much say whatever you want within reason. You know, $1,000 a month, you could say whatever. There is no hearing that justifies this, and there is no debate over the matter. And furthermore, and this is also something I didn't know until recently, the child custody case has already been established without a hearing, and that is also built into these laws. These orders. Within 10 days, there is a hearing. The hearing lasts between 5 and 10 minutes in front of a judge, and it is a civil hearing, so you are not guaranteed a lawyer. And yet, the woman has a free one, or often a free legal team, and a script that they memorize, if they need it, to, you know, they say all the right things, hit all the talking points necessary to get a judge to make a temporary order permanent. No evidence is required. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and I have all the case law to back this up if necessary. Actually, I should tell you, there are two papers. The one I mentioned on Europe Wide concerns, feminism and these kind of claims, as well as it relates to international political economy and the American economy. But there's another one, actually more specifically on Belfort Box, that has been titled "The Victorian Origins of Feminism." It's not my title. It was given by an actually very good journal from England called Western Spring. And so this is the other paper, actually, I think more comprehensive paper concerning the privileges that women have had, that women have ruled, not just today, not just in 2016 America, but even in Great Britain and during the second half of the 19th century. We're talking about the Victorian era. And I am speaking about Belfort Box only because he simply goes through the case law of his own day and the statutes as they existed. And so and just lists them. So there's no question this is not his personal opinion. So let me quote from him. 1907, I never do this on this radio show, but it's worthwhile. This is what Box says in 1907 concerning the situation of gender relations in Great Britain. Quote, "If a man under any provocation, no matter how galling, insolence or violence, strikes a woman, he is sent to hard labor, divorced, his property confiscated, or his earnings garnished. And all this through the prompt instrumentality of the police court. A woman might assault, stab, set fire to her husband, and he has no remedy except to summon her to the police court, where, if she be fined, he is compelled to pay the fine, and as likely as to be laughed at. If her crime is relatively atrocious, she is perhaps sent to prison for 1/20th part of the time awarded to a male offender for a similar offense. On her being released, her husband, unless he be a rich man, is bound to take her back, rich or poor, and support her. The prompt and inexpensive police court divorce is not for him." Bax's argument, and I simply use the false claims idea to back him up and to make a separate claim, is simply that even in the Victorian era, women were privileged. Now, as a Marxist, his claim was that therefore they are charging rents, they are expropriating male surplus labor, as it were, based on sexuality and their approval. The value to one's self-esteem that comes from female approval and that kind of acceptance and validation has tremendous market value. So he's approaching this as a Marxist. And of course, from that point of view, as well as from the point of view of the natural law side, he actually makes an excellent claim. The point is, these kind of arrangements are quite economic and are very similar to the sort of exploitative relationships that exist within the family, even in his. So really, there's two things going on here. On the one hand, there is my research that I had to engage in. I do that for extra money now and again, the Bar Association, but also from coming across Belfort Box for the first time. Box was made me come to the conclusion, and I made the argument in over these two papers that feminism isn't about women taking power. Feminism about women justifying the power that they already have. Box is making the claim that legally and economically, women use sexuality as a marketable commodity. So in his era, for example, women were totally immune from any kind of corporal punishment. And the most interesting part is that they are seen as less culpable for violent actions because they were seen as incapable of them. Even a female murderess were never hanged, regardless of how nasty her crime was. Even in the Victorian era, he makes a claim that female prison sentences are much, much less, roughly around 80% in general. Men have 80% greater prison sentence than they do. Because sexism, as we might say, said that women can't make her own decisions within the family structure, and therefore she can never be held culpable for a crime. And because they were the weaker sex, which of course in terms of physical life and logic they most certainly are, the Victorian Great Britain, in a series of laws passed in the middle of the 19th century, said that because women are weaker, not just physically but also mentally, they really can't be criminals because they're not capable of making independent decisions. If she is married, then we can only assume that a crime that she commits is something that her husband put her up to. And in terms of both of these research papers, both of these opened me up to a world that I'm embarrassed to say that I didn't know much about. Not that I accepted the narrative that women were slaves up until, you know, yesterday. It's a feminist line. But their privileges and just how these societies, even in the 19th century, were going out of their way to make simply being a woman almost a noble title. But I have to say, it really was the protective order racket that got me so disturbed and so upset that I actually had to call actual lawyers specializing in defense matters to make sure criminal defense matters, even though this is a civil matter, civil case, is still very much treated by lawyers as a criminal matter for verification. And in fact, most defense attorneys won't take these cases. And as one, the female who, an old friend of mine, will deliberately lose those cases, that they'll throw those cases. The concept being that feminist organization in every county is so powerful, you have a lot to lose if you irritate them. You have nothing to lose if you irritate your client, especially if the client's a nobody, and they generally are. The fact that very few of these hearings have a lawyer for the defense, because it's a civil case, is also very, very important. I was told, and this is what I couldn't believe, I was told by my one female contact, a lawyer in Harrisburg, said there is no law governing these hearings. It's whatever the judge wants. I was also struck by the fact, and I didn't know this until she told me, that if this law is violated, if the protective order is violated, The man is arrested, and the court case is secretive. There are no records of it. You can't research it online like you could a normal criminal case, even though it is a criminal case. Jury trials are banned. You cannot have a jury trial for a violation crime. And any fine has to be paid in cash, and in no other way. Now, this is a normal criminal case. If you violate one of these restraining orders, you are arrested and you are charged with a crime. Oddly enough, it doesn't seem, at least in the state of Pennsylvania, it doesn't seem to have any status. In PA, misdemeanors are, you know, first, second, and third class, the first class being the most severe. I believe that a violation, which technically is a form of contempt, is a misdemeanor 3, the most minor a crime you can commit and still have it still be a crime. But that jury trials are banned, and that everything has to be done in cash, and there can be no witnesses. In other words, this is not a public trial, like everything else is, even though it's a criminal trial. And that I was told that there is no law, that there are no standards to use for a judge coming to this conclusion, that somehow you violated this order. And the maximum sentence is 6 months in jail. A man goes to prison for 6 months. He's lost his home. He's lost his job. He's pretty much lost everything. Now, this is what struck me. So a woman has a problem with her husband or her boyfriend. She goes to the feminist organization. The feminist organization gives her a script, gives her a free lawyer. They go off to a judge, and all she has to do is cry and say she's afraid. I'm not being flippant here. This is precisely what happens. That's all she needs to do. She needs to show no evidence. She needs to show nothing other than the fact that she claims to be afraid. The free lawyer that she receives, sometimes more than one, knows precisely what to say and knows exactly how to. They even have outfits there. They dress them up if necessary. The man is then removed from the home. As I mentioned before, 10 days later, there is meant to be a hearing, which is meaningless. Evidence you didn't do something, you didn't do the things that led to her being afraid, are irrelevant. I really should mention, I know I said I wasn't going to, but there's four cases in the state of Pennsylvania. DeHaas versus DeHaas in 1998, Ferry versus Ferry, 2008, and several others within that 10-year period demonstrated that no proof is required for one of these protective orders to be made permanent. Another one is from the same year, 2008, Burkhalter versus Burkhalter, as well as McCants versus McCants, which is in 2006. All four of these make the claim that evidence is not important. The only time that a woman would, actually a judge would pay any attention is if he has doubts as to her being afraid. And the Supreme Court of PA is very clear. It says evidence that there's any wrongdoing here is only worthwhile if it helps you believe that she is in fact afraid. I don't know how to defend against someone. How do you prove that someone is not afraid? If there is simply, and there simply would be no reason to hire a lawyer if in fact there is no law, that there is no standard here for any of this. This is the only area, the point I'm trying to make here is that this is the only area of law where this is the case. Due process, rule of law, both the Fourth and the Fifth Amendments are completely and absolutely removed. The Supreme Court of Pennsylvania said that this passes constitutional muster because there is this evidentiary hearing. But the very same Supreme Court also said that no evidence is required for this hearing to go successfully. There is simply no way to defend against it. As a result, the only time that these orders are rejected by the court is if there's been reconciliation, if the person bringing the suit doesn't show, or if the during a hearing, if the female position is so absurd and she's so demonstrably insane that a judge will reject it. It's extremely uncommon for one of these to be rejected, and no evidence is required. This is especially the case if there is a criminal trial going on for, let's say, something like assault at the same time. If that's the case, then the man who has this order against him during the hearing really can't say very much. He can't defend himself really at all without saying something that might be used in the criminal trial. Now, it also seems to me that since a lot of these protective orders are taken out without an arrest, that in and of itself to me proves that it must be false. Because if he's done something violent that deserves that kind of punishment, then certainly he should be arrested and there should be criminal proceedings. I might also note, and I didn't know this until I spoke to my contact in Harrisburg, that in Pennsylvania, I think in most states as well, if you are accused of this and you are arrested for assault in a domestic situation, one of the conditions of your bail is that you can have no contact with your alleged victim, which means in a domestic situation, the very accusation of domestic violence means that you can't go home. I have the feeling I know why men are committing suicide in huge numbers. I was sent a transcript and a summary, a case study by one of the female lawyer that I've known for a long time in Harrisburg. All the personal information was redacted, but the case, this is really what struck me. This is why I couldn't get through the whole thing. It was so heartbreaking. Young guy, 18 years old. His girlfriend just had a baby. The two of them are living together. I believe this is in southern. I think they're in Waynesboro, southern Waynesboro, but not quite to the Maryland border. He is a mechanic. He's making about $700 a month. And he is, by their description, you know, very meek and small and just a gentle individual, a gentle man. He had a PFA placed on him. No proof, no evidence, no bruises, no nothing, which it wouldn't be relevant anyway, even if you had them, it wouldn't have any bearing on it. He's kicked out of his house. She is there with a newborn. He moves in with his mother, who is just down the street. He, when this thing is made permanent, and he didn't know, you know, he had no lawyer, she had several. It was made permanent. The order was for $800 a month in support and the normal kind of supervised visitation. So, in other words, they took the passing of the PFA, the protective order, as proof of domestic violence. That's how twisted the system was. I was told the very next day the new boyfriend moves in. Now, I contacted a few people, asked if this is common, and they said it is very common. Demonstration of this, not necessarily in these cases, but in false assault cases and sexual assault cases and rapes. This is a very common phenomenon. And I asked, well, you know, what happens if the woman has moral qualms about this? You know, this is a terrible thing to do to somebody. And I was told that the feminist group in each county also has to have a staff of counselors. And these counselors generally justify what these people are doing. They, in fact, create these cases. They create abuse situations that a woman didn't even say because she's very impressionable, because it's such chaotic. To go do something like this, there must be a lot of fighting. It must be a lot of trouble. She is distraught. But because of that, she is very easily influenced, and they have been known to create alleged memories of violence, things that never occurred. And if there is a criminal trial, the protective order is used as evidence against him. There is simply so the point is, for any male who is married or living with a woman in the state of Pennsylvania, he is not secure in his property or in his person. He can be removed from the house because she's sick and tired of him, or she met somebody else. The woman who does this will then be guaranteed an income if there is a child involved, can control this man to remove. And as several articles here made the claim that, and I believe this, that these kind of, that the real motive for making a false claim, especially not something as serious as rape, but something like assault, claiming to be a victim of domestic violence has a tremendous emotional consequence. Number one, there is a huge support structure that already exists and is in place. Number two, you have a different status. You are treated more gently. No one would ever fire someone from a job who had made this claim. You're seen as this brave warrior and hero. Number three, and most importantly, anything that the person did, the woman did, to cause the fighting can now never be brought up, because, you know, if you claim violence, somebody said, well, what did you do to cause this? That is in terrible, terrible taste. And that person will be victimized as a result of that. So the person's slate is wiped clean. Now, if you have a free lawyer on permanent retainer, which is the law in these cases, and free counseling, which justifies and enables all of this, you're talking in any given year something like $100,000 worth of services. And I discovered, and I found this out very recently, that the existence of a protective order means that you cannot be turned down for any state services. So if you apply for Medicaid, for example, one of the questions that they ask you is, are you a victim of domestic violence? If you say yes, and you can demonstrate that, then you cannot be turned down for the program. So these claims, bringing out a false, bad faith protective order against a man, has tremendous emotional payoffs and extraordinary, tremendous financial payoffs. The only downside is that you have to live with yourself. And I believe this is the reason why men are killing themselves in huge numbers in this country. And if you are accused or arrested for violating this order, there is no, the trial is secret. The trial cannot be, is not listed online in court records. And there is no jury possible or allowed. And there is no standard. So pretty much anything you do will lead to a conviction. So now you will have a criminal record. If you are kicked out of your house, if you have had your kids taken away from you, your home taken away from you, your marriage or relationship destroyed, your social status destroyed, now humiliated in front of the community, overnight, and for no good reason, you have been turned into a pariah. you might be angry at this. So needless to say, any fool realizes that chances are the guy is going to get on the phone and start yelling and screaming at this woman. Well, that of course is a violation. So it's pretty much guaranteed, unless you are, you know, unless you are just so mellow as to be impossible, you are pretty much guaranteed a criminal record as a result of it, and jail time. Now, I talk about all of this because I understand why men are reluctant to marry. Why, you know, this is the nature, but this, here you have a situation where the rule of law is completely violated. There are no constitutional protections. There is no due process for any of this. And furthermore, you are attacking a man at his most intimate level of vulnerability. Marriage, relationships, sexuality, his children, his home. And you could be removed from it with absolutely no consequences to her. No cost. You actually, the man has to pay all the costs of the proceedings. And she gets tremendous reward. And there is absolutely every reason for a nihilistic woman to want to do this. And you then can get, and in the case, the one case study that was sent to me, this mechanic in Waynesboro, 18-year-old guy, she quit her job. Because she brought the boyfriend, new boyfriend in. She had been a teller at Walmart. And she quit her job because he, now this poor guy who was making $700 a month, mostly under the table, had to pay $800 a month in support. If you don't do it, you have your driver's license suspended and you go off to prison. And because it's part of a protective order arrangement, there is no hearing for it. It's simply demanded by the lawyer, by the free lawyer given to these women. And the custody arrangement is also not done through a hearing. It's all within, and this is what I didn't know from before, this is all within the protective order itself. So what's the conclusion here? I mean, this is something that I can't believe it exists. I can't believe that I had to get on the phone and speak with three criminal defense attorneys to make sure that I wasn't going crazy. This actually is the case, and they also stated to me that it's normal. There's nothing exceptional about the case study that I just told you about. This is ludicrous. The thing is that it's men who passed this law. It's men who justified it. It's men who were overwhelmingly victimized by it. And there is an entire faction of males that wants even greater penalties. So if you are a space alien from Venus, so to speak, and you are observing this law in action, your only conclusion is that not only is it a gynocracy, but it is an absolute totalitarian one. And that men are the ones who designed this system, knowing that there's a good chance that they will be victimized by it. And then I hear that criminal defense attorneys don't want to touch these cases because there's very little chance of winning. That actually having done something has no relevance whatsoever, according to the cases that I just cited you, in terms of granting one of these. And that you're guaranteed practically a criminal record because your anger, your justified anger at having your life destroyed and having your children taken away overnight for no reason, will spill over into contacts that are forbidden. The thing is that some of these are called no contact. You can't speak to her at all, which A, makes reconciliation impossible, and B, it seems to me, is a violation of the First Amendment. It's one thing to ban, you know, you have an order that says you can't say I'm going to kill you, but you can't say anything. There's no good reason for any government to do that. Now, if this isn't proof of gynocracy, the absolute fanatical, irresponsible use of power, then nothing will convince you. In the state of Pennsylvania, very few of these are rejected. When I say rejected, I mean that they're not granted because the hearing didn't go the female's way. That's very, very, very rare. It only happens when she doesn't show. Overwhelmingly, these things are signed voluntarily by the man, usually because the feminist organization will say something like, "We won't tell your employer about this if you sign this without a hearing." I asked if this was common. All three said it's very common, in fact, standard procedure. Part of the problem here is that women who are actually beaten up by these drunks and drug addicts, I mean, this overwhelmingly the sort of men that beat their wives or girlfriends, are increasingly not being taken seriously. I mentioned the, in the past, I've mentioned the case at Stanford with the very famous swimmer, Brock Turner. He has been publicly humiliated. His life largely ended. He was going to be in the Olympics. The trials were just around the corner, a few days from his conviction. And as a result, he is now barred. He was a shoo-in. He is now barred from competition forever. Now, the media said that he was a rapist, but California law only bans sexual assault, rape being a subcategory. Going to the going directly to the court documents, any separate rape charge considered sexual assault was dropped. The only thing that this guy did, and pardon the vulgarity, is that he used his fingers. Now, this was in university. They were both inebriated, and there were two witnesses who came after the fact, and they said that they saw him raping her behind the building. There was a dumpster there, and that he was, you know, thrusting in the sense that he was having sex, and yet there's no evidence for that. There's no evidence for any penetration except his fingers. So the witnesses weren't telling the truth, or it was exaggerated. There was an outrage, a total uproar in America when he was only given 6 months in jail. Now, they normally refuse to countenance the idea that what he did isn't so bad. He was one of the most popular kids on campus. The thing that made me laugh about it was that she probably would have had drunken sex with him voluntarily in a short period of time. I'm not justifying what he did. It's stupid and vulgar. And guys like that think they could do anything. But they were both inebriated. Neither one could have given consent. There was no sex involved. What he did not amount to rape. It's unpleasant to talk about. But he said that she had given consent. They were both drunk. I'm not sure how she can withhold, or that it's impossible for her to consent because of inebriation. And yet, the same level of inebriation with the perpetrator is not an excuse. He is in total control of his faculty. It's another one of these female privilege proofs, is that when the victim is inebriated, she cannot be said to consent. Now, that there's certain truth to that, of course. And yet, if you're inebriated, in his case, if you're inebriated when it happens, you are treated as if you are fully responsible. This is what, when Brock Turner wrote his letter, which was condemned in every media outlet, he said that this is just college culture. This happens every day. It's just that it's not necessarily caught on camera, and witnesses don't normally see it. This man's face has been plastered all over the web. He has been humiliated. They want to put him away for 30 years. There was in Baylor last year, I think I mentioned this already, there was a black football defensive tackle who was convicted of the exact same crime and served exactly 6 months in jail in Texas, and no one said a word. And the regime is talking about all the privileges that he has. But these reporters are talking about privileges that he has at the same time, condemning him to the skies, ensuring that he will never probably have any decent job ever again, that he is now permanently marked. He has to register as a sex offender wherever he lives, including having to go to his neighbors and tell them for something that did not amount to rape. So he is now included in the same category with people who like little boys. He's in that same category now, because normally people think that, you know, sex offender is a sex offender. And of course, more importantly, he could not be an Olympian, and he would have been on the American Olympic swim team, as if that's not sufficient punishment for something that happens dozens of times a day, an hour on college campuses, and is not considered amoral or abnormal in college life. Plus the simple fact that all of this kind of behavior didn't exist prior to the modern era. This didn't exist prior to the 20th century. College students always behave badly. This goes way back. But the sexual revolution is very new. And they were simply pursuing their interests, whether it be alcoholism or sexuality, as they saw fit, according to the mentality of the sexual revolutionaries. But now the feminists they have unleashed the male libido and now have criminalized it. It proves that there is no privilege here, and it proves that we live in a gynocracy. On the other hand, the alleged victim of this terrible crime, which is, of this terrible crime, already has had 4 job offers coming into her because of this. I'm not sure what the connection is, but these are very good job offers. Her tuition is paid for the rest of her time at Stanford. She has been lionized, called a hero, called courageous, called wonderful. And I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that she's also been asked to run for office. Now, they protect their identity. There's a certain, you're talking about a real sexual assault, something terrible like that happened. In reality, this is not a crime that should be tolerated. But Brock's argument that he wrote in his article, he said, this is college. And of course, he's correct. In the college mind, he did absolutely nothing wrong, and she's quite aware of it. I read the letter that she allegedly wrote to him, and several things stood out. Number one, it wasn't a allegedly traumatized college student. It was professionally written. Number two, it hit on all of the liberal talking points in terms of feminism and sexual assault in America. So it clearly wasn't written by her, written by somebody who was hired and who knew how to hit all of those buttons. And number three, it demonstrated a pretty serious understanding of psychology, because they're going after American males in this, in some of their weakest points. So what the regime has done is, on the one hand, unleashed the male libido, and on the other hand, then criminalized it when it gets out of control, which, of course, the libido always does. The worst part about this is that it hits men at their most vulnerable. It is an assault on natural law and decency, on the rule of law, rules of evidence. There is no other area of law that's like this, only where the women are concerned. In my experience, I learned this. Thank God I've never been accused of anything like this. I don't know what I would do if that would be the case. Hiring a lawyer certainly is out of the question, because they can't do anything for you. But my wake-up call, apart from some of the stuff, women and romance and having to ask them and pay for everything, apart from that, when I was in St. Louis, I got my master's degree at the University of Missouri at St. Louis, they instituted a program, which I think is now everywhere, that to walk across campus, a woman, a girl, can request an escort, which has to be brought to her almost immediately. So they are given bodyguards the minute it turns dark on campus. Now, if this isn't a demonstration of nobility and noble status, I don't know what is. And I didn't use the phrase "the new nobility" as this flippant insult. I used it in a very, it's accurate. Having spent many, many years reading about noble status in different parts of Europe and the rest of the world, doing what I do for a living, this kind of analysis, all you do as a historian is really talk about people of noble status. The exact same immunities and privileges that they had, women had, and not even necessarily attractive ones, but just women as being female. Number one, your case is believed immediately in court when it comes to these kind of domestic or sexual issues. generally speaking, the man has to prove his innocence. This is universally acknowledged. And furthermore, there are several movements of very powerful political forces that want to make the burden of proof to be officially and formally on the man. Right now, it's only de facto that the man has to prove his innocence. But there are several people who want to make it absolutely mandatory that the female is immediately believed. I came across the work of Crajik, C-R-A-J-I-K, in 1993. Having studied almost 600 rape cases in a specific area, one-third of these, and these include convictions, showed no DNA match whatsoever. This is a very common way to disprove it. A huge proportion, in addition to that, simply didn't make sense. They were suspicious. Things didn't kind of add up. Ultimately, it was a handful of these, I think it was 553 cases he looked at, a handful turned out to be actual, provable, legitimate, DNA-based rapes. Now, we need to be very clear here. Number two, the other, we're listing these connections with noble privilege. On the one hand, number one, they are believed in court. This is very typical in that a noble's testimony was more important than a peasant's testimony. That's number one. Number two, their status is, I mean, they could live without working. We have all seen it happen. A woman goes into a bar, goes into a party, and if she is even vaguely attractive, she just sits there, and everything comes to them. They rarely have to pay for it. They never have to pay for anything. And men are, you imagine the self-esteem inflation here for a woman if you're average looking and six men are ready to kill each other over giving the privilege of how to be exploited by you for a few moments of bliss. This is the case with nobility as well. Wherever they went, they were treated with exaggerated respect. Their status was extraordinary compared to the average peasant. Number three, the penalties against them for the same crime was not as severe as for the peasantry, and we have the exact same thing with women, even going back to the Victorian era. There is a movement right now that I just read about in the Wall Street Journal that there is to be a ban on women ever going to prison. Now, prison should only exist for severe violent crimes. Otherwise, I don't see the point of prison. What is the point of prison as a punishment? You know, you hear a district attorney arguing in favor in a sentencing hearing about how the man should be punished, and he says, "Well, you know, a fine can be used for good things. It can go to fund various programs and everything. Now we're not going to worry about that. Community service. Well, the guy can be made to work and make up for the crime that he committed. We're not going to worry about that. Nah, here's what we're going to do. You are going to sit in a room. And that's it. That'll show you. What in heaven's name is the point of this?" I never understood prison. We're talking about short-term sentences here. We're not talking about, you know, the rest of your life. Only there in the state system can you, you know, you take classes and do all that. And I think the private prison system is only for long-term. At least in Pennsylvania, the county is legally in charge of the jail. It's not a prison. In Pennsylvania, it is only 2 years maximum for someone to stay at the county jail. Above and beyond that, you go to state prison, and God knows what that's like. But at the county jail, there is really no, except for the longest serving people, there is no work. I see absolutely no point to this. And yet, if you violate one of these protective orders, which certainly is almost inevitable, you will serve jail time, even if it's only a few days. Number three, in terms of the nobility, you live from rents. A rent is really what usury is. A rent is anything, any money that is extracted because of non-economic position. It's money extracted from someone involuntarily based on non-economic conditions. In this case, the rent is extracted because the woman has a very valuable commodity as to her body as well as her approval of you. And that is worth a tremendous amount of money. I mean, obviously, the way men spend spend money to get this kind of approval, it must be of immense importance. So in that sense, there is a clear connection with the nobility. Number four, their crimes are not seen as serious as others. It is a completely different matter for a woman to commit a violent crime. They are furthermore petitioned, as the old nobility, as monarchs were. You go to them with whatever you want, and you have to be poetic about it. You have to do very, very well. I mean, you have to flatter them. You have to entertain them. Now, this is almost a caricature of the old nobility. Now, a lot of this stuff isn't quite true. The nobility in Russia, for the most part, was a fairly, especially after Ivan the Terrible, was a weak and highly divided and often impoverished class. That changed under Catherine the Great. So you had periods of noble rule, but in general, the overwhelming majority of those with noble titles were fairly poor. So they were not, we need to be very clear there, and the responsibilities were crushing. I think it is very clear that American women, especially if they're attractive or even vaguely attractive, are the new noble class. They're a Brahmin class that cannot be touched. They cannot be even yelled at or argued with, because there are plenty of women who see that as an assault. It is legal harassment. It is also grounds for a protective order. It is grounds for a violation of a protective order. So even speaking sternly to a woman can cause tremendous problems for a man. Wealth and power have nothing to do with this. The granting of these restraining orders based on no evidence has no connection with the victim's wealth or status. So it is because she is female, not because her victim is poor or marginal. This happens to everyone. And of course, there's always the notion that any crime that is committed against a peasant by a noble is often laughed at. The woman hits a man in a domestic violence situation. The man doesn't report it. Imagine getting on the phone. Oh, my wife is beating me up. I mean, no one's going to report this. We have no idea. I mean, we have studies coming in. Oh, there's people like Farrell and Cunningham concerning false accusations and female violence against men. Yeah, they're already talking about 60% of non-reciprocal domestic violence being female. But it must be much higher than that, because men never report this. There is no way, people complain that there are no violence shelters for men. But I laugh. I say, can you imagine being a male and running off from your home, with just a shirt on your back, needing a domestic violence shelter because your wife is mad at you? I don't know, what man is going to do this? Domestic violence against men happens every single day. It's far more prevalent than, and part of the reason is because women are of this noble class. They know that nothing will happen to them. The other proof, the other connection with the old nobility, that there is no penalty for perjury. Even in these cases where DNA evidence has exonerated a convicted rapist, unless it's on the front page of the paper, there is no action taken against the false accuser. In a domestic violence, in a restraining order situation, there has never been in the state of Pennsylvania a case penalizing someone for making a false claim. I was told by three defense trial attorneys that you will never win, except under extreme condition, a case against a woman when it comes to protective orders. And there's no point in trying, and therefore there's no point in hiring a lawyer. Finally, the connection between women and the nobility also isn't the sense that the burden of proof is completely different. There is no burden of proof in these cases for the woman. There's none. There clearly wasn't any. I mean, Brock Turner was found guilty by a jury, even with the insane problems with the case. You know, contradictory witness things, you know, all these kind of things. I don't know if he's guilty or not, but what he's guilty of isn't a big deal, especially in college. Now his life is over, and this woman is now granted a tremendous. She's got everything she wants now. She has not been traumatized, especially since she doesn't remember. She was passed out, allegedly. So how could she be traumatized? This is a media-generated concept. Forcible rape is a very serious crime, and these men need to be punished. Preferably by something other than being forced to sit in a room for a while. But it is also a very powerful weapon for a woman to advance herself in terms of status and in finance. In these cases, even beyond domestic violence, but in these cases, female testimony is taken immediately as true unless proven otherwise. Male testimony in these cases is assumed to be false. Again, very close connection with kind of our caricature of the old nobility in old Europe. Now, I went on and on about this, partially to show, number one, this is how power works. It isn't a machine gun on every roof. It isn't a totalitarian government. These are the means whereby the postmodern world exerts itself. Number two, this is an obvious attack on the family. Because there's no contact in most of these orders, reconciliation is impossible. Therefore, it's guaranteed divorce. I've also heard that these advocacy groups at the county level always and without fail say to get rid of the person who you're with, and they often use they will take away your free lawyer and your counseling if you don't. Number three, it's proof of a gynocracy, of a gynocratic totalitarianism that was written by men and enforced by men. This is a complete, because women are so powerful, feminists are so powerful, they have been able to override common sense, the rule of law, habeas corpus, due process, the Fourth and the Fifth Amendments in every state in the country. So that we live in a gynocracy. I could go on and on about, you know, female privileges in university, and that 80% of all discretionary spending is female, that about 60% of all healthcare dollars is for women's medicine, that breast cancer is a national obsession to the point that some kids don't believe there are any other kinds of cancer. And testicular cancer is mocked, but breast cancer is you know, has billions and billions thrown at it, proving that women's lives are seen as more valuable than men's lives. I could talk about all that too, but the fact that this system exists and that it is used by the unscrupulous, and that in an age of relativism, in terms of at least sexual values, there is no truth and there is no right and wrong, therefore why wouldn't you do this? That a woman is guaranteed an income, she is guaranteed total domination of her ex, she is guaranteed the home, she is guaranteed all social welfare programs, she is practically guaranteed a huge amount of emotional support, assumed to be telling the truth, it called her courageous and everything else. She goes up the social ladder by making these claims. And it has to stop. I want to pray for all these guys who've had to suffer with this. I have been lucky so far. But there are men out there whose lives are over. Their home, their children, their job, their status, their friends, everything is gone because allegedly he hurt her feelings one day. And she was having a bad day. And the process of being evicted from your home takes about 5 minutes. That women have the state as their personal bodyguard, and in the case of university campuses, literally a personal bodyguard that's granted to every female who requests it when the sun goes down. Women rule, and feminists rule, and this is triple for those who are attractive. What a life it must be. Now, of course, attractive women, there are downsides here. I mean, number one, as I said before, you have to have sex with a lot of ugly people. And number two, you have a conscience. And so I spent a lot of time on this. This is something that struck me. This is something that I was shaken when I read these, when I did this paper. I then wrote the two papers that I mentioned here, the one on Box and the other one on the one on Victorian feminism and the other one on female rule, and that the connection with the old nobility is substantial. And this is the result of out of control female power, the assault on the family, the assault on the male, who is the protector of the household, the complete destruction of the household, and the atomization of individuals. This is why, of citizens, I should say, this is why men are killing themselves. 80% of all suicides are male. This is why it's happening. This is why depression hits males far greater than it does females. This is why women have a tremendous social network structure and men have none. This is why. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioAryan.com.